Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to episode 6 of Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to be talking to Enterprise producer Dave Rossi about his proposal for an animated Star Trek show, which unfortunately never happened. But he's going to tell us all about it and tell us how awesome it is and how much we missed out on this idea.
Yes.
But first, let's talk about some news, shall we?
Let's talk, Mike. Let's talk. I feel that we do have something to discuss this week. I do.
So apparently, depending on how things work out in the actual movie, but it looks like Rihanna is the latest person to join the Star Trek family as a creator of sorts.
Yes.
She's got a new single called Sledgehammer, which is, I forget, do they say from the motion picture Star Trek Beyond or based on?
No. Yeah, it's like from.
From?
This is an actual like soundtrack tie-in. This is harkening back to the old days of Prince soundtracks and that sort of thing. Music from and inspired by the motion picture.
But I miss those days. And it seems, you know, that we haven't had that recently, which is weird. You'd think that there'd be some tie-ins, you know, somewhere along the line, but there aren't.
Yeah.
But now there are, in the most unlikeliest of places, Star Trek Beyond, Rihanna.
Yeah.
So they dropped the single, and then a couple days later, they dropped the music video. And, yeah, okay, well, first things first. Apparently, Rihanna's a huge Star Trek fan.
Yeah, watched it with her dad, apparently. And I don't know if you got the same read I did, but when she was talking about it and she kept talking about how she watched it with her dad, it became so clear to me. You know, people have said, you know, oh, this isn't my Star Trek and that sort of thing. And, you know, there's been that battle in the fan base, whether the Kelvin timeline is valid or not. And it's like her saying repeatedly, oh, I watched it with my dad. That's exactly what Paramount is trying to work against.
Mm-hmm.
Like Rihanna in that moment is sort of like a bridge. To be like, oh no, I'm not nuts about Star Trek the way you guys are, but I watched it. I'm a fan. I like, you know, like I'm one of those people that likes Star Trek that, you know, is okay with them doing different things. Now, I mean, that was my read.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, like Star Trek fans, they're so, you know, precious about it, of course, you know, that I think, you know, anytime someone comes in and says, like, I'm a Star Trek fan, it's like, well, did you pass the test? You know, that kind of thing, which is crazy because, I mean, like, I'll say, you know, like, oh, I'm a fan of the Dick Van Dyke Show, you know? But, like, if you ask me, like, have you seen every episode of the Dick Van Dyke Show? I'd be like, no.
Well, see, the thing is, I consider it an artifact of that, there's gatekeeping that goes on, but the thing is, it's like, it's not unique. I mean, there have been so many times where I remember being in college and I was trying to hang out with the cooler kids on the loading dock smoking a cigarette, right? I mean, I was going to smoke the cigarette either way, honestly, but I wanted to hang out with the cooler kids. And so I'm sitting there and like some bands came up and I had like just a cursory knowledge of some of these bands. So I was like, oh yeah, I like them. And the guy turned to me and goes, what's your favorite album? And I was like, the one with the song on it, you know, that one. And I just sort of like had to blend back into the corner. So I get it. There are people who act like that.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate because, I mean, not everyone, I mean, that ultimately I think is one of the reasons why when you talk to someone who's not a fan and you say like, have you seen the new Star Trek movie or are you going to go see Star Trek? They're like, no, I don't watch Star Trek, you know? I mean, it's just like they're intimidated by it in a sense. And it's not even like intimidated like, oh my God, you know, these Trekkies are just too cool for me. But more like that is a closed world and I can't get into it. You know, it's too late for me to get into it. And, you know, these movies are trying to open that up. And, you know, it would be nice if fans would just, you know, lay off and let people enjoy Star Trek if they want to, you know?
Well, yeah. I think that what magnifies it and makes it worse is the fact that Star Trek has existed on the fringes for so... I mean, yeah. Okay, we're on Trek FM. We're all huge fans, obviously, of Star Trek. That's what brought us all together.
Yeah.
But Star Trek has existed sort of on the fringes for a while. It's not Star Wars.
Yeah.
Star Wars has always been that big cross-cultural hit.
Yeah.
And Star Trek has always been that niche hit. So I think that this is a weird moment for Star Trek fans to exist where they're finding out that other people might be interested. I think that honestly can catch somebody off guard to be like, what? You like Star... You know, like, it's... I don't know. I guess it's like meeting Cybox Army. There are more of them than we know.
I guess so. I saw a couple pictures of her, like paparazzi pictures. There's like one where she's got like a Deep Space Nine t-shirt on, like a vintage like Deep Space Nine t-shirt.
Nice.
On. That's pretty cool.
Nice. Yeah. That is legit.
Yep. And she's doing a song for this here movie there. They dropped the single Sledgehammer, and then they dropped the video, like we were saying. So yeah. First off, what did you think about the song?
I like the song. I like the song a lot. I don't care whether it's attached to Star Trek. Like, you know what? This is one of those weird things. A song like this is supposed to bring other people into Star Trek, and I'm a Star Trek fan, and Rihanna releases songs all the time, and I'm like, I could care less. But I listened to this one because it was the new Star Trek song. I was like, all right, I'll listen to this. And I found out, yeah, this is pretty good. What did you think?
Yeah, you know, I had a similar reaction, you know, like I work with a lot of younger people, and, you know, when this thing dropped, you know, I was at work or whatever, so I turn it on my phone, you know, and the whole time I'm like, you know, like there's people over there, and I'm like, yeah, it's Rihanna, yeah, I'm listening to Rihanna, yeah, I can be cool too, you know, and it's like I'm honestly like I'm not that familiar with Rihanna's, you know, discography or whatever. I've heard all of the hits, and you know, I've never been tremendously impressed by any of them, but I did like this one quite a bit. It reminded me a lot of like a Bond theme, you know,
which that's a good. Good read. I agree with you.
Which I love the Bond themes. I love all of them to varying degrees, you know?
Well, yeah. Some of them you can love ironically.
So, yeah, I mean, I do like this song. I think it seems to capture, you know, like a certain, you know, weight, which I'm assuming they're hoping the movie has or whatever. Yeah. It's cool. Then they released the music video, which they released it online, and then... starting on Friday, or I guess Thursday night, it was playing exclusively in IMAX with The Legend of Tarzan. And this was, they're saying that the thing that they keep on saying is like, this is the first music video to be shot entirely in IMAX. And it's like, what does that mean? I mean, you saw me on Twitter today. I was like, can someone tell me, because they have this new digital IMAX camera, you know, which is like an Arri 65 or an Alexa 65, an Arriflex Alexa 65, which is like an amazing camera. Like that, they use that for like The Revenant, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, you know, the image, they're using it for Rogue One, you know? The image quality is astounding, right? But then IMAX is like, we are teaming up with them to make an IMAX camera. And then you go to Arriflex and they're like, IMAX is customizing one of our cameras. You know, and it's like, okay, IMAX is pretending like they're joining up to like reinvent the wheel, whereas Arriflex is like, they gave us a bunch of money and they want to stick some extra doodads on it. That's fine with us. You know what I mean? That's the impression that I get.
I'm going to take a moment just to say Stage 9 here on the Trek FM network is the only show I'm aware of where you're going to hear somebody get this upset about camera technology. But other than that, I thought that Rihanna's music video looked fantastic. I really liked it. I thought that the color choice, like I hope we were getting some sort of preview of the color palette for Star Trek Beyond. Because I thought that a lot of the color choices were they just blended so beautifully. I really enjoyed them.
You know, I mean, I liked a lot of elements in it. Like, I liked the fact that you could see, like, in orbit the starbase Yorktown, you know, just kind of like floating there in the sky like the moon would or whatever. Like, I thought that looked really cool. And I mean, the shots of the Enterprise in space I thought were really, really amazing and stuff. But on the whole, like, as far as music videos go, I was not really impressed. I mean, it was just like her standing on a rock singing with those ships flying around. I mean, like, if I wasn't a Star Trek fan, you know, if I didn't, like, recognize elements from the movie, I'd be like, this is just boring, you know?
But see, the thing is, I don't know that I would expect anything more from a music video for a tie-in song. Like, that's sort of the story of music videos for tie-in songs of all time, with the exception of Bat Dance. Like, Bat Dance was its own thriller level production.
Yeah, Bat Dance
and should always
be amazing.
You know, adored. But
yeah.
And so the thing is, like, this fits that template, but at the same time, I thought was much more interesting because the camera movement was more interesting. And there were elements where, like, she was looking over the hologram. Mm-hmm. I thought that was cool. Who knows if it was or not, but I almost took that last shot of her head, like, floating in space in front of the Enterprise as, like, a callback to the original series.
Yeah, that's good. You know? The omnipotent being or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was a neat callback. And so, like, I don't know that I would expect any. I mean, I'm not going to expect a Paul Thomas Anderson Radiohead video.
Do you think it takes place in continuity? Is there any reason why it couldn't?
Wait,
I guess we don't know, right? But it could this video theoretically take place in the Kelvin timeline?
Why not?
I mean,
there's
I guess we'll
absolutely
find out.
Nothing. Yeah, there's nothing. You know what? Let's withhold judgment till we've seen the film. Then
hey,
we'll know.
You know what? Why don't even? I mean, since you brought up the idea of, you know, Rihanna theoretically being an omnipotent being, you know, whatever. What if, like, you know, IDW, you know, Mike Johnson does a comic book?
I'm going,
like,
with this
prequel. Yeah. Where we see the story behind that video.
Oh, make her... No, you know what? Take the idea of one of the Watchers from Marvel Comics in the 80s that did the What If series, and she's one of the Watchers, so she sees where they're going, and or she breaks her oath and gets involved and pushes them along the way so they can learn a lesson. That would be very Star Trek-y.
Yeah, yeah. All right. I guess that pretty much wraps up Rihanna's story for now. We will continue to follow this story, see whether or not she's actually in the movie, vocally speaking. So let's move on to our feature presentation, shall we? We've got Dave Rossi here, and we're going to be discussing his pitch for his animated series, which was called Star Trek Final Frontier. So let's take it back just a little bit. You're on Enterprise, and what exactly are you doing on Enterprise for those people who may not know?
Well, my main job, and it was a job that Rick Berman created for me, was a made-up title called Supervisor of Star Trek Projects.
That sounds like the best job ever, by the way.
It was a pretty good job. You know, they typically, on Star Trek, they typically didn't hire Star Trek fans. And the reason is because you would just stand there gawking at the engine room all day or whatever it is you were doing, you know, while you should have been somewhere else. So I had to lie about getting in. But once I was in, it became apparent very quickly that I knew a few things about Star Trek and had a very deep passion for it. And so Rick at the time was, Next Gen was wrapping up and DS9 was starting and Voyager was getting ready to come off the drawing board. And it was a very, very busy time. And Rick realized that the show at that point, by the time Next Generation was in its seventh season, it was so popular. I mean, you couldn't go anywhere without it coming up somehow. And so the studio had certainly a chance to capitalize on all that through licensing, merchandising. I mean, there's a big publicity machine, a marketing machine. And so that demanded a lot of Rick's time. And Rick was, you can't split a person that way. I mean, there's just too much going on. And so realizing that I knew my Star Trek, but also that I wasn't caught up in it to the extent that I couldn't think about it in a, from a business sense as well, Rick created this position for me, and I would be the person that went to the studio meetings regarding all of these projects. And then I would bring them to Rick, and we would have these weekly meetings where we'd go over everything that the studio was doing, unless it was, you know, for the bigger projects, the kind of day-to-day running of things. Like, I would meet with the licensing group. I don't know what it was, maybe every 2 weeks or every month. And they would just go through this litany of everything that they were preparing to release. And so, for, you know, we would kind of cherry pick the higher end items to talk to them about, and just make sure that everything, you know, licensing departments are, they're great. They bring a physical component of something you love to life. But there's also those people that want to put the Enterprise on condoms. I mean, it's just like, you know, you get on this role where something's popular, and it's just, where can we market it? Where can we market it? And so, not that they were, that's not something they did, but the point is made. And so we just wanted to make sure that everything that they were putting out, that they weren't kind of tipping their hand that way and going a little too far. And they weren't, they were very reverent about Star Trek, and it was a great, great group of people. And so anyway, that's what my main job was. I spent the sixth season of Voyager, and Rick was kind enough to let me, I got to sit in on all the casting sessions, all the writers' story breaks, all of these things. So I could really kind of see how these components all work together. And it was a very fascinating learning experience, because I came into this not as a film person. And I know, like, a lot of people read, you know, or read Inside Star Trek and Making of Star Trek and all these kinds of different books that launched them into, oh my God, I want to be in this business. And while I read them, it didn't do that for me. I was still, you know, a punk kid living in Buffalo, New York. It was just what it was. But I was lucky enough when I got out here to land the job, but not because I had some great love of film or went to school for it. I just got incredibly, incredibly lucky and landed on Star Trek. And so that, I have no desire to work in other TV. I mean, if an opportunity came, certainly I would weigh it against something, but the fact that it was Star Trek at that time was just, how can you go wrong, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to experience more of what the show was about and how I could get my hands more creatively involved in the actual show rather than the ancillary stuff. And Rick, again, was kind enough to let me do second unit and insert shoots. It was my job to produce those. So the way it works is every three or four or five episodes, you gather little snippets of things that you need for those episodes, you know, close-up shots of hands or, you know, inserts of a control panel or some MacGuffin that's in the show or whatever. And you save all those up and you shoot a whole day's worth on a stage somewhere just doing those little things. Here's a hand pulling the trigger on a phaser. Here's, you know, whatever it is. And so that became my responsibility. And so I did that on Enterprise for the four seasons that it ran. And that was also very rewarding. Being on the stage and being collaborative with all these people was really a lot of fun. So those were my two big components. And, you know, I was kind of a Swiss Army knife. You know, it's like whatever Rick needed, you know, if somebody was too busy to do it, I would jump on.
That's really cool. Yeah. That's
awesome. Actually, it's beyond cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah. It was a really, really fun time to be there because the studio was just, you know, I don't think Hollywood works this way anymore, where we had a brazen amount of autonomy, mm-hmm. where, you know, there were no studio notes and network notes. And I mean, that stuff just didn't happen for us. The show was very successful. Every season that Next Gen went on, it just got more and more popular. And so the studio was just have at it, you know? And so that sixth season through, you know, kind of midway through Voyager, it was just like a golden age. It was a really fun, fun place to be.
Yeah. And it shows in the work too. I mean, that is really like the golden age of Star Trek, you know, with Deep Space Nine and everything.
And so many people were there for so long. I mean, so many people started. I didn't start until very late in the show, but people, there were people who were there, a few people. In fact, they took a, kind of like a class picture when Enterprise wrapped up. There was, I don't know how many people it was, 8 or 9 people that were still there that started on the very first shooting of Next Gen.
Wow.
And,
wow.
And so, you know, when you have that kind of family going, when you have that, that system in place, it's just like a well-oiled machine. It runs really well. You know, you don't run into too many problems. And so the studio was very willing to let us just kind of go and do our thing. And I don't think you can do that anymore. I think you get notes from a lot of different levels these days.
Yeah, I can imagine. Sure. So, okay, so 2005, it ends. It all ends. And that's seems to be about the time when you started developing this animated series. Like, what was the inspiration for wanting to get, I mean, I know that's a stupid question, you know, but what was the inspiration for wanting to get Star Trek back?
Well, I always kind of had a feeling that Enterprise kind of missed a little of a mark for me. And I know a lot of people, I'm going to get slapped around by fandom here, but I know a lot of people love season 4 of Enterprise. They feel that is its best season. But I think, you know, obviously it's, people say it's the best season because it references so much from other, you know, original series mostly, but these things that we're so connected with because we know them so well. You know, I mean, they went and like the Organians, and, you know, to me, that's a mistake. Captain Kirk's going to meet the Organians and they're going to give him this, you know, lecture, and that's it. I wish we would have taken it in more of a direction where it really was about how do you form this body that will become this unbelievable device to explore and find friendship and strengthen and learn. And it's a huge thing. And I think we kind of, for me, we missed the boat when we kind of glossed over that. We got to it at the end, you know, where we see Riker. But we see Archer make that speech. But I wish we would have relied less on, not to say that they weren't great episodes. I just wish we would have done more to fill that interim gap without having to reference so much from the original series. I wish we just would have, you know.
So if you were to pick a season from Enterprise where you feel from those first three where you were closest to getting to that mark, which one would it have been?
Well, I think season one is the season that has us most dealing with the fact that we are new.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, everything is new. They're scared to use the transporter. They're, I mean, you know, everything is this kind of discovery. And, you know, Rick had a nickname for me. He, for a while, he called me Dr. Death because as the show was being developed, I made a suggestion that, okay, what if you were a fan of the original series and in season 3, they killed Sulu? If the internet had existed back then, it would have lit up the next day. Mm-hmm. With people, yeah. You know, now you have Game of Thrones where, I mean, it's just, you know, they're willy-nilly about the deaths. But I suggested, boy, what if we created a cast of secondary characters that don't show up all the time? But, you know, this guy's in a briefing and he has a couple of funny lines, and this woman's on the bridge and she's really good at what she does. And you just kind of get those feelings of those people around the ship, and then you slowly start taking them out because space is dangerous, and it can be wonderful and awe-inspiring. But, you know, one of the things I loved about the original series, one of the things that captivated me as I was a little, I started watching it when I was like 7 or 8 years old, but, you know, as I got a little older and got to appreciate the storytelling, one of the things that I just absolutely loved is when they were alone, when Kirk had to make a command decision. And there was, you know, well, Starfleet's going to get back to us in 2 weeks. And these are like galactic choices. Yeah. I loved that aspect of it. And so I think that Enterprise in season one has a lot of that, where they're just kind of on their own and having to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was the most gratifying. Now, I think we went a little too fast with, you know, obviously they wanted to let people know it was Star Trek. So you get phasers kind of right away, and communicators and tricorders, and there's Vulcans on the bridge, and, you know, all these kind of tropes from Star Trek that we know. But, you know, it might have been kind of fun to see them still using test tubes on a planet to gather samples and to do things. You know, it might have been fun to discover that a little more and discover, you know, like, I love the phaser episode where, you know, let's just shoot that mountain and the whole thing blows up and you're like, okay, that's why this is the weapon of choice for the next 300 years, you know? And things like discovering deflector shields and discover, you know, I would have loved to, you know, chomp on that a little more, but I think the first season is the closest of that for me, that they're alone and out there for the first time, and it's scary and it's, you know, fun. And I think that's what it should have been. And then we start getting our sea legs and becoming, you know, then humanity starts exerting itself in a way that aliens aren't kind of ready for, because we're so unique and we're pretty damn cool. So, you know, the Federation forms, and I think those would have been great moments. I wish we would have just played it a little harder. So Rick's assistant at the time is a guy named Doug Mirabello. And Doug and I at the time played poker together pretty regularly. And we're both Star Trek fans. And I approached him one time and I said, hey, why don't we take a stab at writing something about Star Trek? And we kind of came across, we started looking at, you know, my heart is in the 23rd century. And so I wanted to do something from the original series. And so we decided to write a spec script for the Excalibur. And it starts with the destruction of the Excalibur and, you know, all the people getting killed when the Ultimate Computer episode happens. And it's now refitted and a new captain. And so we and the Kelvins were going to be the bad guys. And so we wrote this script, and we had brought another acquaintance of mine in. And it didn't go so well. The pairing of all three of us didn't go so well. But Doug and I were still, kind of always talking lightly about it. And then one night I was out at dinner with another friend of ours, a guy named Jose Munoz. And I said to Jose, what's missing from Star Trek for you? And what would you do to get it back? And he said, they're not moving forward anymore. It's kind of the same story over and over, and there's nothing really exploratory in the sense that the original series had, and even that Next Gen had to a certain extent. But and so we started just kind of getting into this conversation about it. And then I was watching Clone Wars, those little 3-minute episodes, which were awesome.
Yeah, the Jenny Tartakovsky series on Cartoon Network. Yeah,
which I'm sure John will agree with me is way better than the second Clone Wars series.
Way different. They're way different.
I'm gonna go with better.
All right.
You know, they could do in 3 minutes what that you would walk away going, wow, that was compelling.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Cool.
They really did great stuff, and so I started thinking, could Star Trek be adapted that way? And I don't think you could do it in 3 minutes, because the thing Star Trek has that Star Wars doesn't is there's a lot more storytelling going on. And I think the need for a lot more dialogue, and not to, you know, anger Star Wars fans. Star Wars is great. Star Wars is great.
Oh, no. As a diehard Star Wars fan, I get what you're going for. Star Trek needs a lot more flesh.
You need to be able to take beats and let people talk, and, you know, and so that's hard for animated shows. I mean, you don't want to be on the bridge and have an extended dialogue scene in as an animated show. It just doesn't play that well.
Yeah.
So we kind of toyed around with it and thought, I bet we could do it in 6 minutes. Tell an episode in 6 minutes, but tell one story over a bunch of those episodes. And so the three of us got down to writing it, and we kind of all had the same, you know, we kind of all threw it into this pot. Boy, what's missing, and what do we want to see? And one of the things, again, that was missing was kind of the feeling of them being on the edge of being out on the frontier alone, having to make these decisions. And another thing we felt was the Federation, it just felt kind of complacent, you know, at the end of DS9 and Voyager, I mean, at the war and everything, but it just felt like nothing was happening. The sense of exploration and discovering new worlds, it just didn't, you know, happen. And I think Star Trek works best when that happens, because, I mean, the whole point of it to me is us bettering ourselves. And the way you do that is by experiencing things through these eyes of these other creatures that you run into. I mean, that's the great mirror for us. And so we started talking about, well, when would it be set? And we thought, we don't want to do next gen. We don't want to do that era. So let's go forward. We went ahead to 2525 or something. And we decided, okay, we're gonna have a captain who is on a ship called the Enterprise, but the Enterprise is no longer this ship of the line in that sense. It's no longer this shining example of humanity's best. It's kind of a mid-level ship doing a shit-ass job of patrolling the border. And the reason that there's a lot of ships patrolling borders is that sometime after the next generation era, 50 years later, an event happens within the Federation. And we felt that you can't just have another ship exploring and the Federation's just getting bigger. It just didn't feel right. So we wanted to kind of shake things up a little and get us back to that kind of frontier mentality that existed in the original series. And so we came up with this idea that 50 years after Next Gen, a series of these Omega particles explode all throughout the Federation and the Romulan Empire. Mm-hmm. And they create these areas that you can't use warp speed in anymore. So some worlds completely destroyed, some are just cut off, and now they are years away from having any help from the Federation. But it does start a war between the Romulans and the Federation because both think they started it. And they fight this trench war for a really long time. It's really like going over hedgerows and starships because you just have to go so slowly. And eventually resources wore thin and everyone got tired of it. And finally, they both said, you know what, just you stay where you are and we'll stay where we are and let's just call it a day. And so that's kind of what happened. But during it, there were ramifications. The Andorian homeworld was destroyed. And so, you know, there's a group of Andorians obviously still alive or off planet. And they're kind of a louder voice in the Federation right now about, you know, being very much more militaristic and seeking out people. During the war, the Romulans take over Kronos. So the Klingons get dispersed, and they are now these kind of nomadic, but they still have ships and technology, but we wanted them to be, you know, kind of what Enterprise was doing with them, but I don't think we achieved it as, you know, voraciously as I would have, is we want the audience to be afraid when they show up. When Klingons show up, we really wanted people to be like, oh, shit, this is not going to go. Go the other way, dude. Just go the other way. And so we kind of had that set up. And then Vulcan leaves because we decide to go to war with the Romulans. They secede. No one's heard from Vulcan, you know, since before the war. And we start on his name's Captain Archer, and he's a guy who was born at an Outer Rim planet. And it took him 11 years to get into the Federation. He was on this kind of, not a generational ship, but he was on this ship of people that decided to make the journey from outside to inside. And he was just a boy when he did it. But it taught him a lot about how to maneuver through these dead patches and study them. And he knows a lot of things about them. So when he gets to the Federation, he wants to explore and he signs up for Starfleet, but Starfleet is a much different thing today. Today, it's you have to shoot first and ask questions later. We are xenophobic. And it's just this culture of change that has happened. And if we would have been able to tell the whole arc, we would have eventually revealed the villain, who we still might write it. So I don't want to say who it is, but it's awesome.
Okay.
All right. But there was this speech we had written for this villain who kind of says, you know, don't ever go up against humans because they'll beat you every time. They'll beat you when they're down. When you have them in a corner, they're going to kick your ass. But you know what? Don't put them in a corner. Just scare them. And if they're scared, they start turning a little more inward. And so it's this thing about how that's what's happened year after year after year of this fighting, and now the Federation losing worlds and people dispersed. And we just become, you know, insular. And it's more about protecting ourselves than the old tenets of Starfleet and the Federation, which is seek out new life and new civilizations. So Captain Archer and his crew are on this ship, and he is a, you know, he's a rebel. I mean, as far as Starfleet's concerned, he wants to start that mission again, but he's not on a ship of exploration. The Enterprise is not an attractive ship, which we kind of wanted to go for. And I know when we first, we have a website that people can go to, I'll give it to you later, but if they want to look at all the design work we did and everything, and the most comments we get are how awful the Enterprise looks. And that's kind of the point, because if we would have been able to let this breathe, the fun of it would have been watching this captain bond with this ship and watching this poor pig of a ship pivot and become the ship that starts setting the Federation back on track. And I think it would have been fun, because it's one of those things where when you see a strange looking character in a show that you like, and you're like, ugh, I don't know about that guy. But then that person starts doing something that you like, you start going, hey, I like that guy. And that was kind of our feeling for the Enterprise. We wanted people to go, I love her. She's great. Even though she looks like a, you know, and so, so we have that. And then he's got this very diverse crew. His first officer is a guy who is he is by the book Starfleet, the Starfleet of today. And so for him, the idea of, you know, talking to people to figure stuff out, no, we have to scare them a little. And it's not that these Federation and Starfleet ships are evil. They don't just, you know, fire. They're not pirates. That was some of the blowback we got too, is, you know, the Federation would never, you know, and it's like, it's not that we're jumping out and killing people. It's that you better have a good reason for why you're here. And, you know, we're not going to have tea and sandwiches waiting for you. It's time, you know, you know. And so he is by that book. And so there are a lot of regulations. And he was just about to get command of his own ship. And the Federation, Starfleet said, we want you to be this guy's first officer because we need somebody who can keep him in check. He's out on the kind of rim right now, and it's dangerous. And we would just love it if you would do us this favor. And so he does, and he's resentful. So he doesn't, you know, outwardly hate the captain or anything, but he is resentful because he should be the captain of his own ship now, and he's babysitting instead. So we have that little dynamic going. And then we also reference an event that happens that causes the formation of something called the protocol officer. And every starship now has a protocol officer, and that person is responsible for reminding the captain about how Starfleet works and why we do what we do. So that person is there to just say, I'm sorry, you can't do that. And they have a direct line to the heads of Starfleet, more so than captains do. And there are these really annoying officers that the captain just can't get around. And in our episode, in the opening episode, his name is Preston, and he and our captain are friends. They've known each other for a long time. And so they have a little more banter between them, but it's kind of like, it's for Preston, it's kind of like babysitting a younger sibling on summer vacation. You know, you're just like, don't worry. They're never going to know, you know, and don't please, you're going to get me in trouble. Don't do this, you know? And it's all been very minor kind of things that the captain does. He wants to go explore something he's not supposed to go to. He wants to, you know, but always within the Federation and always kind of following that rule. And then we've created this group of security officers, and they call themselves the Red Shirts. And they're led by a woman named Kaylin Donnell. And in today's Starfleet, when you become part of security, you are given your permission to have this piece of technology implanted in the side of your head. And it's based on Borg technology, and it allows all security officers to, on a particular ship, to stay in touch all the time. So you know, if you're a security guard, you know what's going on with every other security officer around the ship or on away missions or whatever it is. And they have all these kind of cool little devices that they work with now. We had like, we gave them these little like transporter bombs. So you like would throw this little device at a wall and stick on the wall, and then the wall would beam away and just beam into space.
Oh, that's awesome.
Or beam somewhere else, you know? So we gave them all these kind of little things, and people on the ship don't trust them because there's still obviously great fear of the Borg. But we learned that this technology, this is where Starfleet started going down the wrong path, you know, kind of a Section 31 kind of deal where we're losing the war with the Romulans. We need to kick it up a notch. What are we going to do? Well, we've got this Borg technology we've stolen over the years, or we've studied over the years. Why don't we do something with that? And so everybody's fearful of these security guards. And we wanted our security guards to be, calling them red shirts is kind of the joke. The first time we see them in action, we want people to go, oh man, those guys are awesome. You
know? Cool.
And so when you lose one, you know, in a fight, it's not so much funny as it hurts, you know, where you're like, oh dude, that sucks. Those guys are so good. And so, and she's the best of the best, and she's got this, you know, really overwhelming desire to prove herself to the captain, and the captain just doesn't trust her. He doesn't trust the whole Borg thing. And so they have their whole issue. And then we had the chief engineer is a guy named, they call his nickname is Zero. And he comes from a world called Prime that is based purely on mathematics. And he's like the best engineer in Starfleet, but he's awful with people, like zero social skills. And so he's kind of a loner, and he's always trying to learn. Not, you know, obviously the correlation to data kind of comes up, but it's not like he wants to be human or he can care less, but he would like to be able to talk to people. We have his whole thing going on, and we have some other secondary characters sprinkled throughout, but that's kind of the premise of the show. And in the very first episode, a ship comes barreling towards the Federation border. And now the Federation border has these little automated sentries all around it. And if you get too close and don't respond to a general hailing frequency they send out, they just shoot you. And so this ship is coming and not responding. And so this thing, you know, these satellites fire up and blast this ship and almost utterly destroy it. And the Enterprise picks up the signal, and so they head over there to check it out, and they find that there's a life form still alive. So they, you know, the captain Captain Chase says, you know, I want to beam it aboard. And the protocol is like, no, absolutely not. You are not beaming any kind of alien on board this ship, you know. And of course, he gets his way, and there's security around, and they beam him over. And it's a very, you know, one of the great things about animation is that you can do these kind of crazy alien creatures. So, you know, multiple arms and whatever we had, you know, him designed for. But he's trying to communicate with them, and they can't, you know, this universal translator's not quite doing it. And he dies. And when he dies, his hand opens, and inside his hand is a Next Generation era comm badge.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
And, yeah. And so Captain Chase says he was coming to us for help. He recognized us. He recognized that this is the Federation, and he's got some, he, you know, charged across with no weapons. He's got just this ancient piece of technology. We have to go check it out. And they're all like, whoa, what are you talking about? And he says, no, we, you know, it's time. It's time we, and they're like, you're going to get fired, dude. That's it. If you leave Federation space, that'll be the end for all of us. And so, Captain Chase gets on the comm system, and he makes this speech about, it's time to stop being afraid. It's time to stop. Somebody's here seeking our help, and it's time that we, you know, and so he kind of fires up the crew, and everyone's kind of like, well, if we're going to go down, this is a good way to go, I guess. And so they head off and get involved in this adventure where they find an old Federation starship, and that these aliens have turned into a kind of a hovel because they're being hunted by these other creatures. And so we just get embroiled in this thing we shouldn't be embroiled in. And it has a lot of consequences for Captain Chase. But at the end of it, we make some friends. And the final couple of minutes is him talking to a hologram of some admiral at Starfleet who's just chewing him out and saying, you've broken every regulation, you've done this, you've done this, you've done this. How would you like to patrol a little further outside the border? And you find that there are people within Starfleet that because of this action, they're with him. They're, you know, even though they're having trouble getting around their own kind of this set of circumstances they've created for themselves, there are people who believe that let this wild card go. Let's see what he can do out there. I mean, you know, it's the Enterprise. It's not like if we lose it, there's, you know, because it's not, again, this ship of the line. And so, but it is pretty badass and it does some pretty badass things. So that's the first episode. And it leaves with him getting assigned to going towards the frontier. And he gets these specialized ships these little kind of shuttle ships that can traverse the areas of space you can't travel through at warp. And they can do it, but they're little, like kind of shuttle crafty. And so Doug wrote, we all worked on the pilot together. And then just for shits and giggles, Doug wrote another one. And we've all been kind of threatening to write more, but you know, it's, we have families and it's not something that's happening. And so, and we also, if you go to the page, there's all kinds of artwork. We were so fortunate that there are so many passionate Star Trek fans. And when they started hearing about what we were doing, people just volunteered their time. I mean, we had somebody storyboard the whole script for us for nothing. And
wow.
I mean, people designed uniforms for us, designed ships for us, designed aliens for us, the way the crew looks. And so it was all going to be animated. It was all going to be these kind of 6-minute episodes. And we went at the time to StarTrek.com, which was based still at Paramount, and they loved it. We were sure it was going to move forward. And then Paramount and CBS split. And CBS got control of Star Trek. So the guys at StarTrek.com moved over with CBS. And we ended up meeting with the head of home entertainment for Paramount. We thought, what about if we did direct-to-DVD videos of this? And they loved it, but they said, but we don't really control it anymore. We're not quite sure how this works after this split. So they recommended, and they were kind enough to set up a meeting, that we go talk to the CBS digital side, which then housed StarTrek.com. So we did, and they really started fast-tracking it. We met with a couple animation houses here in town. We worked up budgets. We had the script finalized. We were moving ahead. And then it was right around Christmas time, and StarTrek.com was cut loose. They just laid off everybody. And their online digital world just became nothing. And so it just fell. There was just no outlet for it. And then a year later, whatever it was announced that J.J. Abrams was doing Star Trek the movie. And there's a deal between Paramount and CBS, a kind of a fair use deal between the two, that at the time was, as long as Paramount's doing a movie, CBS can't do anything, put anything on TV or the internet. And the rights to it were still so very kind of vague and undefined based on how recent the split was. Nobody really knew who controlled online stuff and what constituted what. So it was just a total, you know, wrong place, the wrong time.
Yeah, this split seems to cause so many problems, you know? And no one knows what's going on. No one knows what one person's doing or the other person's doing.
Yeah, it was a confusing, and I guess it's kind of settling itself out now, but back then it was really hard to do anything with Star Trek because nobody wanted to bite because nobody knew what the ramifications of what they were doing were, if they would get popped for something it was just...
That's crazy. That's very disappointing because this idea sounds pretty awesome. I mean, it sounds like...
No, I was just going to say, I'm sold. Like, I want to see this. I want to see it now.
Yeah, right?
You know, come on, man.
It sounds like
what do we got to do?
You really found like a story which fit the format that you were going for, yeah. and a way to sort of, because you know, like everyone's saying, like, you know, for example, well, we've got a new show coming on now, and there's, you know, a big question about when it's going to be set. And I know that a lot of fans are like, you got to set it in the future, you got to set it post next gen. And my thinking is always like, well, where can you take it? Where can you go after this? And your concept sounds way more interesting than anything that I've ever thought of as a possibility, because it shows that the Federation has become something different, but it's still trying to get back to where it's supposed to be, you know?
Yeah, we were just trying to do something different than, okay, now you're in a ship and you're exploring, the Federation's just getting bigger.
Right, right. And it leads, it seems like it would lead to more conflict, more action-oriented stories, which, you know, you kind of need, like you're saying, for that short, you know, 6-minute format.
Right. And you get to do things like, you know, we had arcs set for when the Vulcans finally return. And we had arcs set for, you know, I mean, things like, you think about all the planets within the Federation and how we've carved it up. And now you can go to a planet that normally you consider one thing, Beta Z or whatever it is, and it's completely changed because now they're on their own. They've been on their own for 50 years or whatever it's been, 100 years. And how has that changed them without Federation support? And with, you know, some of them, there's a star base there, but that's it. And so, what, you know, how did these planets change and politics change and economics change for all of these things? And we thought there could be some really fascinating storytelling in there. There was a whole overriding arc where the entity that started the war did it for this exact reason, did it for this reason that they knew that the Federation would turn insular, and that's what the villain wants, because he can control them when they're like that. And they're humans are much more easily manipulatable when when you can get them scared. And so we have it all mapped out and everything, but it's one of those things where it would have been really fun to do back then. Frankly, I am really excited that Brian Fuller's doing what he's doing. I mean, he's going to do some amazing stuff.
Yeah, it certainly seems like it. But, you know, that doesn't mean that there isn't plenty of room in the universe for other people to do their things too, you know?
Right.
So.
Yeah.
So, well, how, just because I'm curious, because you're talking about arcs and stuff, how many episodes did you kind of envision a season, and how many seasons did you envision for the show?
That's a really good question. I think we broke each script. They were, I think, 30-minute scripts broken into 5-6-minute pieces. So 5 installments gave you 1 episode.
Okay, so you have like a full like 30 minutes written, not just like the 6-minute exactly. episode. Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, so the first episode is 30 minutes long, yeah. And then we went back in and broke it into these 5-6-minute pieces. And then I think, you know, Doug had it all. He's the mastermind behind figuring out the schedule. And I want to say that there was 8 to 10 episodes or something that constituted 1 season. And I mean, we had it figured out. We had to go talk about, is it going to be on once a week? Is it going to be on every day? Is it going to, you know, once? And he had a great plan for it. It's just, you know, it was 10 years ago. It eludes me.
That still sounds really cool. That sounds really cool. Yeah, it does. I wish it would have happened. Well, thank you very much for telling us about this show. I mean, it sounds awesome. I mean, where can people find your website where they can actually see where all this stuff is?
One is zeroroom, one word, .squarespace.com. That will bring you to the main page, and everything's in there. There's written scripts, there's storyboards, there's design work. The characters that are along the top next to Star Trek Final Frontier, you know, we had a lot of people drawing a lot of different stuff for us. So you're going to see stuff spattered all over the place, different design formats and different kinds of things. And I don't think that was necessarily the design we were locked onto. We were looking more at Captain Chase, that you'll see when you look at his bio.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today and telling us all about both, you know, your time on Star Trek and then developing this show too, because I mean we love hearing things like this. It's awesome.
Oh, thanks, guys. But, it's not a day goes by that I'm not reminded how fortunate I was to work on the show, and I think it's kind of a responsibility now to share all that stuff with people, because it's, you know, I won the lotto in that respect.
Well, that was really cool talking to Dave. Whenever you hear things like that, you know, especially since they came so close to being made and then, you know, fell apart because of, you know, politics and business, it's just like, oh God, so close.
It's I think it's just one of those things where it's so weird to get that reminder every so often that with, you know, show business being a business, just so many creative impulses that are planted and just, you know, like you would think like there's got to be some sort of like perfect world out there, alternate timeline, if you will, where this thing got produced, because I'd love to see it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, who knows these days? I mean, stranger things have happened than this thing getting produced, or, you know, maybe they can do it as like a comic book or something with IDW. Oh. I mean, we were just talking about The City on the Edge of Forever last week, you know, that was a comic book. Who's to say that they can't do it as a comic book? I mean, especially like given the format, the sort of serial format, 6-minute episodes or whatever. I mean, come on, that would be perfect for a continuing comic book series, right?
It would.
I'd read it. It would. I would totally read that. Oh, well, who knows? Maybe one day. Well, it's been fun talking about Star Trek Final Frontier today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
50 years, there's been something to carry it this far in that vein of, hey, it's our generation or our era's mythic heroes that we can look up to. Do we dare put that in something that's lasted as long as, you know, literary-wise, Shakespeare and some of the other myths of you know, the ancients that have found a purpose and a use that still speak to people?
The Orb.
Well, the wonderful thing about Z'all is she just has it in spades. You know, I mean, she's been mistreated her entire life by her parents and yet has turned out to be this beautiful, amazing person. Part of that's probably Kira taking care of her for so long now.
Yeah.
Literary Treks.
We have a long tradition here on Literary Treks of taking things seriously and having a good time while doing that. Tonight, well, we were going to take it seriously, but then the comics wouldn't let us.
Melodic Treks.
Over a period of 18 years, McCarthy composed 257 entries of the various Star Trek series, making him the biggest contributor to the sound of the franchise.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. We want to give a shout out to our associate producers,
woo,
Jeff Sutter and Chris Steftenagel. Thank you very much, guys, for supporting the show. We really appreciate it. And if you want to become an associate producer, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and check out all of our goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, seats on our content development team, and more. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And help us out. We really appreciate it. If you want to contact us, you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM, or you can go to facebook.com/TrekFM, or while you're on Facebook, you can join the Babel Conference, which is our listener forum where we talk about all of our shows and Star Trek. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll pop right up. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Kessel Junkie on Twitter. You can find me on Words with Nerds with my pal Craig, and you can also find me on Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing over on the Nerd Party Network. Where can they find you, Mike?
You can find me right here on Trek FM producing From There to Here, which is Trek FM's daily Star Trek rewatch, where we look at all 729 episodes of the show from beginning to end. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. Well, that is it for Star Trek Final Frontier. Next week, 10 Cloverfield Lane. Thank you.